All right, here we are, the first Thursday in February. I almost said November for some reason, but this is Trending Now with Josh Arnold. I'm Rick Moore, sort of pushing the buttons and turning off all the background noise. Our producer and engineer is always Bill Proposky, and your host, Josh Arnold.
And we have a full lineup today. We have Kim Whalen, who's a mediator and a certified divorce financial analyst, going to tell us what those roles are and why they're emerging as very important occupations in today's society. Jack Meany's our second guest. He's the retired CEO at the North Shore YMCA. He's going to talk about the an update on the Fuller School property in Gloucester. Third guest is Joe Cellino, City Council President in Gloucester. And the fourth guest is Kristen Rodriguez, who's a former educational administrator in the Gloucester system, is now the superintendent of schools in Groton Dunstable. She's an adjunct professor and author of a couple of books.
Sounds good.
Harrington's Trophy and Awards has been rewarding the North Shore for over 25 years. Hi, I'm Kevin Harrington.
And I am Marty Harrington, and we are known for our local family business, providing custom trophies, plaques, screen printing, embroidery, and much more. We offer a variety of services such as engraving wedding gifts, medals for charity walks, youth sports trophies and uniforms. From the newest style performance wear to your everyday work shirts, we are your one-stop shop. Whether it's a fantasy football, warm-up suits for your team, end-of-the-year banquet gifts, or recognizing excellence, we pride our business on our exceptional customer service and quality products. Located in Lynn, or visit our website at harringtontrophy.com.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. One of the ways to judge a company is in its staying power. At Moynihan Lumber, we've been doing our thing now for 55 years. Serving all of Greater Boston, Moynihan Lumber offers lumber and building materials, doors and windows, decking, kitchen cabinets, and Ace Hardware. Visit Moynihan Lumber at any of our three locations, in North Reading, Beverly, or Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at moynihanlumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Gloria Food Store is still Beverly's number one deli, and no matter what New England weather is thrown at us, Gloria is open. With fresh bread delivered from Sunray Bakery every morning, Gloria can provide party platters, calzones, hot trays, cold trays, salad trays, and finger sandwiches for whatever you have planned. Call in your order at 978-922-3613, stop in at 268 Rantoul Street, or visit GloriaFoodStore.com.
After immunizing more than 2 billion children, Rotary Club members are close to wiping polio from the face of the earth. Thanks to a matching grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, every dollar Rotary raises will work twice as hard to protect children against polio forever.
Rotary is a worldwide network of community volunteers dedicated to helping people in need. Rotary believes the right group of people working together can make communities and the world a better place. Make an impact. Join a Rotary Club in Rhode Island or Massachusetts. For more, go to RotaryDreams.org.
Well, welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our first guest is Kim Whalen. Kim, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Kim, you're I met you during mediation training, and I thought it would be good to have somebody who is a mediator, and you're also a certified divorce financial analyst, and want to hear a little bit about what you do in that capacity. But first, tell us a little, give us your little bio, and tell us, our listening audience, a little bit about you and your background.
Okay. Well, I have actually a fairly eclectic business background, but about 4 or 5 years ago, I made a career transition, and as part of that transition, I just fell in love with mediation. I've done a lot of different kinds of mediation, but my focus at the moment is primarily on family and divorce mediation, and then I've added, as you said, the certified divorce financial analyst. I realized that a big piece of that divorce mediation work was people making decisions about their finances. So I got certified in that area, and I do a combination of helping people get divorced through mediation, and also financial planning around divorce.
Great. Now, for the listening audience, there are lots of different venues in which people are increasingly called to mediate rather than litigate problems. Tell us a little bit about, share with us a little bit about, if you can, some of those areas.
Sorry.
No.
Well, mediation is really an alternative way for people to resolve their disputes, and I think when people have a problem, the first thing they think of is Judge Judy, all the Good Wife, the legal shows, and going to court. And mediation is an alternative to that. So rather than hiring lawyers to negotiate for you or prepare you to trial, the parties actually sit down with the mediator, and the mediator sort of is a facilitated negotiation with the parties. The mediator helps them think through what their interests are, what their options are, and try to come up with their own solution, as opposed to letting a judge or a jury decide. So I'm a huge fan. I think it's a more peaceful and productive way for people to resolve their disputes than going to court or going to trial.
When you're in a mediation, how challenging is it, and how far apart are the parties with some of the cases that you've had to deal with?
Yeah, it depends. People can be very amicable and just really need a little help and a little structure. And there are also that people come in very angry, very upset, very emotional. And mediation can be a process that sort of productively helps people work through that stuff and understand, you know, what their interests are, what their options are. You know, for example, in divorce, I tell people it's not that people don't come to the divorce process sometimes really mad, really sad, really frightened, but there is a more productive way to work through those issues, and you get people focusing on, we want to do the right thing for our kids, we want to come up with a fair resolution, as opposed to sort of coming from the fear and anger piece. So mediation can be very challenging, but when it works, it's just magical.
Regardless of how people resolve, whether it's litigating or mediating, they bring with them to the table a whole array of hurts, things that they may be angry about, some cases tremendous hostility. Well, you did this, or you did that, or in all, you know, all the sins and all of the grievances people accumulate over a period of time. Well, how do you get people who are really wrought with pain, hurt, and having those kind of feelings, and very willing to express them? How do you get them to kind of put those aside and focus on what's in front of them and guide them along the way?
Yep. Well, there's lots of different tools in the toolkit to help people do that. Sometimes people need, you know, just a little bit of an opportunity to be heard. It's not therapy, but sometimes people just need to be able to say their piece to the other person. I think the biggest thing is just to focus people on what they want moving forward and helping them realize that sort of staying stuck in the pattern of, you know, being mad about something isn't going to move them to where they want to be. So, you know, for example, if they're getting divorced and you get, I've never gotten two parents in a room that didn't say the most important thing going forward is to make sure their children were okay. And so you can help people realize that they have some common goals about what they want moving forward, and that they both are looking for something that they can do together moving forward. So there is a way to focus people on what they want and the risks of staying stuck in the pattern that they're in. But it can be challenging.
And the mediator is not an arbitrator. Is there a false perception by some when they come into the process thinking that, well, they're not going for a judge per se, they're going to go to you and you're going to listen to both sides and you're going to tell them what's the right way to go?
Right. I do have to remind people of that, because people often want to convince me as the mediator that they're the good one and
yeah,
they're making the good decisions and the other person's the bad guy. I keep saying to people, it's not what I think. You know, if you want to convince the other person, fine. But it's not my job to tell people what to do. It's my job to help them think through their options and what's really important to them and figure out ways that they can both get some or most of their needs met. So yeah, it is. I'm not an arbitrator. I'm not a judge. It's not my decision to make. It's not my life. They know their life better than I do. So it's tempting sometimes. You think you see the perfect solution, but it's not my job to come up with the solution. It's their job to figure out what's going to work best for them.
And part of your part of the job of the mediator, particularly in a divorce settlement, is you have to help guide them to come up with an agreement that a judge is going to look at, that a
yes.
judge is going to review and either approve or disapprove. And you have mediators have a sense having interfaced with them of what's going to work and what's not going to work, and you also know what the guidelines are. You know. Whether it's alimony or child support or child time with child or who's the how do you deal with all of that?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. There's a lot of things that they have to be aware of, and it's not our job to give them legal advice or tell them what to do, but we do have to provide all the information. They're getting divorced, as they say, in the shadow of the law. There are a judge. They can come up with their own agreement, but ultimately the judge has to approve it. So it's our job to explain, you know, here's the range and here are the things you can do. And if you're doing something that's sort of, I say, coloring a little bit far outside the lines, then you have to be able to explain to the judge why you're doing what you do. So part of my job is to provide a lot of the information and framework and help them understand here are all the decisions the judge, you know, that you need to make, that you need to tell the judge, here's how we're going to do our parenting plan, here's how we're going to divide our assets, here's how the support's going to work. So part of it's helping them understand what they need to decide, and then as they make those decisions, make sure they're making them within the framework of the law. There's a lot, it's a lot of information. It's not an easy process.
And when you start each mediation session, you convey to the parties that the process is confidential. And yet I know there are caveats to that. Can you explain what confidentiality means in the context of the mediator's role in mediation?
Sure. It's one of the big advantages of mediation is that it is a confidential process. It's not, you're not in the courtroom airing your dirty laundry in front of the world in a public place. The two of you are meeting in private, and the mediator, in fact, you sign an agreement at the beginning. If the mediation doesn't work and you eventually end up going to court, the mediator can't go in and testify for or against either party. So anything that happens in the mediation, we sort of have a joke. It's like what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. What happens in mediation stays in mediation. So it's a very safe, private place to have a conversation, and it's not something that the rest of the world is ever going to hear. The only exception to that, which I think you were hinting at, is if, and I tell people, obviously if they tell me that they're planning to commit a crime or do something to harm someone else or themselves, then that's something where I would feel obligated to break the confidentiality. But other than that, it's a very safe place for people to have a conversation.
And when the if people are airing all of the dirty laundry, so to speak, doesn't a media divorce spare those things being part of the divorce record?
Yes, yes. So again, you know, if you're presenting in front of a judge, you're in open court. There's a, you know, person doing a transcription there. There are all the people sitting in the courtroom. It's a public record that people can see. So I think
somebody wants to drive down to Norfolk District Court and pull a transcript of docket number XXXX53,
right,
and they can read all of what happened, and that may not be something people really want out there.
Right. And I say to people, I think unfortunately there's a lot of superficial legal stuff on TV with, you know, Judge Judy, and people sort of feel like if their justice is on their side that it will prevail. And I tell people, I do a lot of pro bono work in court, that's where we met, and I sit looking at these trials, and I think people underestimate both the expense of going to trial and the emotional toll that it can take. It is not the lawyers, they do an important job, but it takes them a lot of time and people's money to prepare for trial. I heard one judge say it's 5 hours of preparation for every hour spent in the court. There's also a lot of time spent sitting around, so it can be very expensive to go to trial and very emotionally draining to sit there and, you know, duke it out and the conflict can escalate. And as I say, you know, there's one judge in Norfolk that says, "Your congratulations on your divorce. You're married no longer, but your parents together forever." And I say to people, to spend all that time duking it out in court, it makes it very difficult to co-parent afterwards if you've scorched the earth in the courtroom.
So I want to switch over for a minute to your role as a certified divorce financial analyst, and tell us what that is and why it's important.
I think people sometimes forget that many of the decisions that you have to make in divorce really are financial issues. And divorce financial analysts can help with sort of all the aspects of the financial planning around divorce. And it's not one size fits all. There's a whole bunch of different things that certified divorce financialists can do. They can work with the couple together. They can work with if one side is really unsure about their about the financial side of the family finances, you can work with them. But it's helping people understand what their financial situation is, what their options are going forward, so that they really understand where they are and what their choices are moving forward.
Now, in Massachusetts, the prevailing rule is it needs to be an equitable divorce, but equitable doesn't always mean 50-50.
Exactly.
So there are all different kinds of things that Transbase, you know, they look at the total marital assets and liabilities.
Yep. People sometimes forget you're dividing not just the things you own, but you're dividing the things that you owe as well. So credit card debt, you have to decide how that's going to be distributed. There are oftentimes, the classic example is oftentimes couples are getting divorced and one of the parents wants to stay in the home, keep the home for the children. And that can be very difficult to figure out financially. Is that a viable thing to do? How do you divide the assets so that can happen and that can work? There's tax implications to how you do things. So there are lots of moving parts to figure out what's the best solution for this family moving forward.
Yeah, if you have a child in high school who might be a sophomore or junior, they may not want to uproot and go to another town or community. They want to finish their high school diploma at whatever system they're in. So I know in some cases they forge an agreement that after the last child has graduated or whatever, depending on what the age span is and how many children are involved, then the property would be put on the market.
Yep. So there are some creative solutions that you can help people think through, and there's pros and cons to all those decisions. So you help people understand, you know, what are the pros and cons of each option they can choose. It's very interesting work, and I think what you find is in most families, there's usually one person who's been responsible for sort of tracking the family finances, and oftentimes the other party is fearful or just unaware, and so sometimes needs a little help catching up and understanding what their situation is and what their options are going forward. So that can also be really helpful as well.
Just closing out, our next guest is lining up, but how do you deal with the parties that come in and you might have one session with them in the process, and I'm guessing a divorce thing is not something that happens in one session. You're going to meet with them a few times. And how do you deal with the party that goes home, talks to their, you know, friends, their next door neighbor, their parent, or whatever, and says, "Oh, you got to get this much out of it, or you should go to court." How do you bob and weave around that kind of stuff?
Yeah, it's tough, and I think, you know, the first thing when you tell someone you're getting divorced, they say, "Oh, let me get the name of my cousin's lawyer. He got her so much money," and I think that's kind of the place that people go to. And I partly talk to people about, you know, what the downside to that strategy is. I can talk to people. I sit in court. I see what it looks like when people go to trial. It's very expensive. It's very unpleasant. And then I just get people to think back to, you know, what they want going forward. And again, this is a person they're going to have to co-parent with if they have children. And so a lot of it's focusing them on what they want. And most people want to walk away from their divorce feeling proud of the way they handled themselves. And I think, it's important to remind people that what they really want is to feel good about how they move forward and be in a place where they can co-parent their kids.
Great.
And most people get to that point. But the you're right. The people talking in the background can be a little problematic.
Super. Well, I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold, and we certainly wish you the greatest success in your dual role as a certified divorce financial analyst and as a mediator.
Thanks, Josh. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Kim.
Thanks.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. And if you're thinking about replacing the windows in your home, please see the Anderson Woodright replacement windows. Why Anderson? With low-E glass, low-maintenance exteriors, and rich wood interiors, you can turn simple window replacement into significant home improvement. See the Anderson Woodright replacement windows on display at Moynihan Lumber in North Reading, Beverly, and Plaistow, New Hampshire.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Hi, this is Jeff Klickstein, General Manager at Moore GMC in Danvers. Did you know that we're a family-owned and operated dealer that's been serving the North Shore since 1969? Our service department ranks as one of the best in customer satisfaction because we respect our customers' busy schedule and we do repairs as quickly as possible with the least amount of inconvenience to you. We are conveniently located off Route 128 at Exit 23, 80 High Street in Danvers. I personally invite all of you to come in, come visit us, see why our customers keep coming back for all their automotive needs.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is an old friend, former Rotarian, Jack Meany. Jack, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Josh. Glad to be aboard.
We usually start our programs with guests. Tell us a little bit about you and your background, and then we could get into some of the updates about the YMCA and the Fuller School properties.
Sure. I've been here on Cape Ann for, 32 years now. I came here from upstate New York where I directed a Y in Oswego, and I was hired to come here to be the director of the Gloucester YMCA back in 1984, when it was all by itself before all the mergers and before the North Shore Y. And I did that for about 9 years, and then went on to be the executive of the Beverly Y, and then the Beverly Y and the Cape Ann Y merged, and we built the Ipswich Y, and then we merged with the Salem Y and the Marblehead Y, and became the North Shore Y, and then after that we did mergers in Haverhill, and we built the Plaistow YMCA. So right now the North Shore Y is a YMCA with 8 full YMCAs and has about 49,000 members.
Wow.
So that's my little history with the YMCA.
Great. And you are recently retired as the CEO of North Shore YMCA?
I am. I'm in my first year of retirement. I went last year in the middle of March, and I've held on to one project that they've been nice enough to try and let me, and I'll put it in quotation fingers, finish, which is to try and see if we can't get a new Y for Cape Ann.
And I know that's a bigger task than people think. How long have you been realizing that YMCA for Gloucester needs a new location, and what are some of the things that were driving that? Whether the Fuller School property emerged as a possibility or not. How long ago were you saying?
Well, we kind of knew. We knew probably 20 years ago that the location at 71 Middle Street is a difficult one.
Yeah.
It's a building that that was built in 1974, probably doesn't really serve the needs of a new modern YMCA. Very difficult to change because it's a stacked building, and it's in an urban location. And probably the biggest detriment of all is there's just no parking. And everybody that deals with downtown Gloucester understands the situation with parking in downtown Gloucester, and it's particularly acute around the YMCA. And when you're bringing a family or your mom with a stroller or your senior citizen, it's pretty difficult to park two or three or four blocks away and try and get to the Y. So we knew even then that it was problematic. And then within the last 10 years, it's been very difficult for the YMCA in Gloucester to break even. And so what's happened is it's become a Y that each year loses a certain amount of money, and it's a pretty substantial amount. And that amount of money, of course, has to be made up by the other Ys in the North Shore Y group, which fortunately it has been able to do. But as a long-term strategy, it probably isn't very viable. So what has to happen is we have to find a more, quote, family-friendly location for the YMCA.
And the role of the YMCA is forever evolving. I mean, what you did when you were here in 1980, what the YMCA does now versus what it did in 1984 are very different business ventures.
You bet. I mean, the YMCA has been in existence for 160 years in the United States. And the genius of the Y, I think, is that it's always changing. It's ever evolving. For example, a lot of people think about the Y as a swim and gym kind of thing, where if you're a kid, you go play basketball, you go in the pool, you take lessons. If you're an adult, that's where you go get fit. You take fitness classes, you work out in the fitness center. But of course, the Y is all that, but it's also the largest child care provider on the North Shore, the largest after-school child care provider on the North Shore, the largest camping group on the North Shore. It provides achievement gap programs in the summer so kids can continue to learn and to improve on their education. We do senior programs. We do special population programs, and you can just go on and on and on. So what the Y has really evolved to in the year 2016 is the Y is the community center. The Y is where everybody sees their old friends and makes new friends, and where families go and enjoy activities together and separately. So it's really when the Y is done correctly, it's where the entire community convenes. And in our Ys, in our newer Ys in Beverly and Ipswich and Plastow and Marblehead, that's exactly what happens. In our older communities, in Salem and Haverhill and Gloucester, where we're in the middle of downtown, it's not exactly that. It's a little variation on the theme, and quite frankly, it's not quite as effective.
Now, you've got a proposal in.
We do.
For buying the property that is formerly the Milton Fuller School property, the school and the land there.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that the city has still some time left on their timeline to respond to your proposal. Tell us about what the proposal involves.
Sure.
and where you are with that.
Well, as you know, Cape Ann is 36,000 people. And in order to support a really full facility Y, you need about that number of people and more. So location is really important to a YMCA. It has to be convenient to the entire population for it to work on Cape Ann. And so we began eyeing the Fuller site probably 7 or 8 years ago when it began to wind down as a school, and then it even began to wind down as a place for administration and preschool, etc. So what we've been trying to do is we've been trying to encourage the city to put that site out to bid. And over 3 years ago, Mayor Kirk at that time did a non-binding referendum on the ballot in 2013, and what was designated by an overwhelming majority of the voters was that it should be a multi-use site, that it should be for public use, it should be for private use, it should have residential, and it should have commercial. And so that evolved in September of 2015 in what's called a request for proposal that the city put out for bids on a multi-use site. And those bids were put out on in September of 2015 with about 45 days to respond, which the Y and our partners responded to. And we handed in a proposal on November 23rd that has been in the city's hands since that time. And 36 people or 36 different entities took out the RFP, and one party responded to it right before Thanksgiving, and that was ourselves, the Wendover Group, Sam Park and Company, and the Dolben Group. And as a single entity, we responded to this and proposed a multi-use development for the Fuller site, and we bid the sum of $5.1 million for that site. And so the city's deliberating on that right now, and according to the paper yesterday, at least, has designated a drop-dead site for a drop-dead date for a decision of February 23rd. So we're here, and we're anxiously awaiting their decision.
Great. Now, to build a new Y, and I know there's a lot involved, your cost for a new facility, new parking, destroy the old building, land development and all that, what is the rollout cost projected to be?
We're looking at a number between $15 and $20 million, which is a substantial number. And as you probably know, how do you gain that kind of money to build a YMCA for the community? And how it's done in YMCA work is you raise that money. And so we're very anxious to be designated so that we can begin the fundraising process. And thus far, we've been very encouraged about the ability to raise this kind of money and to build a brand new state-of-the-art Y for Cape Ann.
Can you tell us? I understood from a Rotary meeting recently that you have an anonymous, or at least at this point, an anonymous donation to rebuild. If you acquire it, someone
will
step forward. Can tell us about that?
We have been fortunate enough from a very substantial donor to have received an initial gift of $5 million. And that is dependent upon us building a new YMCA within a certain amount of years. And we're obviously thrilled with that. That's a wonderful start to what will be a really enormous fundraising prospect. But when you got a leg up like that, you have a real good shot at getting there. So we're very encouraged.
Assuming that everything goes well, that the city tells it to you, you enter in a purchase and sale agreement and all of that, from the time that you actually are handed the deed, what do you see as a turn? How long is it going to take to build the new Y?
Well, if we were designated, let's say, within the next month, we would have about 45 days to finalize a purchase and sales agreement. At that juncture, once we were finalized on that, we would then begin kind of simultaneously the fundraising process as well as the permitting process. And we expect that the permitting process will take somewhere between 6 and 9 months because that will have to go through the city council and all the other boards in the city. At the same time, we'd be trying to raise money, and that whole fundraising would take us probably about a year to a year and a half, if all goes well. And then we would probably be about 12 months in construction. So we see it at about 3 years from this time, and that would be quite aggressive, I think. So anywhere between 3 and 4 years would probably be the time where we could realize all this.
Great. Well, to thank you for being a guest and providing our listeners with an update on a very important piece of news happening here on Cape Ann, and wish you well with your project going forward, Jack.
Well, thanks, Josh. Appreciate the chance to talk to everybody about it.
Great. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Hello, sports fans. This is Wally, the voice of Honeydew Donuts. All right, you're getting ready to go to a game. I don't care if it's morning, afternoon, or night. Don't forget, stop into Honeydew Donuts and get yourself a cup of coffee. How about that large iced coffee? That Mocha Madness one is unbelievable. You'll think you went to Honeydew Heaven. So remember, you heard it here first on MSONewsSports.com. And remember the name. It's Honeydew Donuts, the only way to go.
Hi, this is Jeff Klickstein, General Manager at Moore GMC in Danvers. Did you know that we're a family-owned and operated dealer that's been serving the North Shore since 1969? Our service department ranks as one of the best in customer satisfaction because we respect our customers' busy schedule and we do repairs as quickly as possible with the least amount of inconvenience to you. We are conveniently located off Route 128 at Exit 23, 80 High Street in Danvers. I personally invite all of you to come in, come visit us, see why our customers keep coming back for all their automotive needs.
Yep. Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is Gloucester City Council President Joe Cellino. Joe, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Josh.
Well, what is your life like now that you're the City Council President? And tell us a little bit about your time as acting mayor.
Well, it's kind of interesting. In a year's time, you know, I got back on the City Council, which was, you know, in January of last year, because Safati Abino became the acting mayor. And then in a year's time, I, you know, got reelected, and I got my fellow councilors decided that they wanted me to be the City Council President. And just a few short weeks later than that, you know, I was acting mayor. So in a year's time, I've collected a lot of hats, and I've been, you know, shuffling between one and the other. But it was an interesting experience, you know, working with the staff, and I was very lucky we didn't have any huge storms and to deal with, and just signing a few papers, and that was pretty much it.
So your role as the City Council President is in part establishing, you have a standing committees and you have to assign people to those roles. Can you give us who has what and who's doing what among the nine city councilors?
Absolutely. What the City Council president does is set up all the committees. And there are three standing committees. And the standing committees are where the City Council really rolls up their sleeves and does the work and then makes recommendations to the full City Council. The first committee would be Budget and Finance, and the new chair of that is Scott Memhart, who's the new ward counselor for Ward 1. And Scott has an excellent background in finance and business, and for the past month or so, he's been doing an excellent job as chairman of that committee. The vice chair is Joe Orlando, who's a new person to politics, and Joe is an attorney, and he's interested in learning how municipal finance works, and so that is a good spot for him. And then the third person would be myself, who's usually the City Council President, sits in on Budget and Finance, and my role on that committee is a voice of experience. I've sat on several terms on Budget and Finance. In fact, that was my first committee when I first got elected, and I sat on that with Jim Nestino and Al Sweckler, Al Sweckler was chair and I was vice chair. So that's how I started off. So I'm there and I'm guiding and moving them forward. The second committee is the Planning and Development. And I chose Paul Lumberg to head that committee. And Paul, you know, comes to City Council with a good experience, you know, at the Planning Board. And so he was vice chair last year. And so he knows planning, and the high expectation he's going to do a great job, especially when we have Fuller coming down the pike at some point in time that we know we're going to have to deal with that. And with that is on that committee also the vice chair is Melissa Cox, and she's always served on Budget and Finance, but I think it was time for a change for her to really broaden her horizons, and so I decided that she would do better at planning development and learning that end of it also. And then the third person on that is Val Gilman, who's a newbie and is learning, and she has an interest in that, and so far so good. Those two committees are doing real well. And the last committee is Ordinance Administration, and I chose Steve LeBlanc as the chair of that, and Steve is also vice president of the city council. And Steve, you know, comes to that position with serving a couple of terms already on O&A, so he's well versed and experienced on how that all works. And he is joined with for the vice chair is Jamie O'Hara, and Sean Nolan also sits with them. So that's also a good team. And interesting too is that on the city side, on the council side, that O&A is in charge of the city clerk's office, and budget and finance is in charge of the auditor's office, because we have a separation from the administration.
Yeah, with the charters, when the founding fathers developed the charter, they wanted that check and balance system, and they put the auditor under the jurisdiction of the city council to create that check and balance.
Right.
And the clerk has always reported to the council anyway, going back to when Freddie Kairos was the clerk.
But then, you know, he looks out for the city council's interest, because, you know, the mayor proposes and the city council disposes, and most times, you know, we're the people that really sign the checks. The mayor can propose spending it, but if you know, we have to, the city council needs to approve it, and I think that's why the founding fathers, when they did the charter, you know, that checks and balance, that you have an auditor that's independent from the administration. And you know, and say, hey, listen, you know, put the brakes on, you know, this is not quite right, you know, you need to do this and this and this. So we have an excellent auditor, and his name is Kenny Costa, and he comes to Gloucester with from Somerville, and he has a wonderful reputation when it comes to municipal finance, and basically, you know, he keeps tabs on all the departments and make sure that everything is running right, and, you know, keeps the council abreast. So who's running over their budget, and who needs to deal with where they're going to transfer the money to deal with their budget. So, you know, that's a big function. He comes to budget and finance at all the meetings, and guides and steers us through it. So he's very helpful. Very helpful.
Right, and we got just about a minute left for our next guest comes on. But what's before you right now? What are the hot items? I know you have to confirm the mayor's appointments. That's in transit. What else is going on?
We did that the other day at Ordinance Administration. We had all the managers come through, and each one was taken individually and discussed. And the Ordinance Administration has moved them all forward to City Council, so that it was a good exercise to go through and introduce everybody, and right now the mayor has assembled a dynamite team, and they're highly professional, and they absolutely know what they're doing. They're a tremendous asset to the city. Now that's next Tuesday. That's moving to Council, and Council will affirm the. You know, their positions also, and then they'll be installed for another year. We don't really have any, you know, any really hot topics. I think, you know, of course, you know, the topics that everybody's talking about is, you know, the back shore and also the Cameron's property or the Fuller's property, but none of that has come to the point where it's going to come to council. I think at some point in time it will. But at this point in time, it hasn't. So, you know, we're watching the committees and you know, do their work, and hopefully, you know, I'm sure that, you know, they'll make the right decisions, and then it'll be moving forward to the city council.
Let me just part with one observation. Growing up on track of Xander Road, we used to measure the storms that the Northeast is and all the winter storms by, you know, how far up the tide came and
right.
How big the waves were when they went over the house out on the point. I just cannot fathom any kind of property on the other side of the road.
Right.
I remember the storm of 78 in which all of the swimming pools were full of rocks and debris from the storm surge. It just doesn't make sense that you could build over there.
We're all trying to figure out what the...
Not that I'm lobbying you. I'm just making an observation. It just doesn't make sense.
Why anybody would want to do that, but here he is, and you know, trying to get through the process. So.
Great. Well, thank you for being a guest on our program again.
Always a pleasure, Josh.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
You're really in for a treat at Sylvan Street. A great place to eat and drink and meet with family and friends at Sylvan Street. Treat you right, day or night, satisfy your appetite. Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
The Sylvan Street Grill has a great new Game Time menu featuring delicious new dishes, specials, and all-time favorites too.
Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
The Bradford Tavern, the Rowley Destination Restaurant, featuring many modern touches, nestled in a rustic setting, offering the finest steaks, seafood, and many quality daily specials. The Bradford Tavern is open 7 days a week from 11 a.m. to midnight, serving lunch and dinner. See you soon at the Bradford Tavern in Rowley, 89 Haverhill Street, Route 133. And check us out at bradfordtavern.com.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. And if you're thinking about replacing the windows in your home, please see the Anderson Woodright replacement windows. Why Anderson? With low-E glass, low-maintenance exteriors, and rich wood interiors, you can turn simple window replacement into significant home improvement. See the Anderson Woodright replacement windows on display at Moynihan Lumber in North Reading, Beverly, and Plastow, New Hampshire.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Hi, this is Jeff Klickstein, General Manager at Moore GMC in Danvers. Did you know that we're a family-owned and operated dealer that's been serving the North Shore since 1969? Our service department ranks as one of the best in customer satisfaction because we respect our customers' busy schedule and we do repairs as quickly as possible with the least amount of inconvenience to you. We are conveniently located off Route 128 at Exit 23, 80 High Street in Danvers. I personally invite all of you to come in, come visit us, see why our customers keep coming back for all their automotive needs.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is Dr. Kristen Rodriguez, the superintendent of schools, Groton Dunstable, but formerly of an administrator in the Gloucester school system. Dr. Rodriguez, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
We usually start out with tell us a little bit about yourself, your bio, your career, and so forth. Share with that, and we can talk about some of the things that you do.
Oh, my pleasure. So currently, right now, I am the superintendent of schools, as you mentioned, in Groton Dunstable, and I've been here since June of 2014. Spent a lot of time on the North Shore in the Merrimack Valley area. I was an assistant principal in Gloucester, at the Fuller School when it was an elementary school building. And I've been an assistant superintendent, director of curriculum, a principal, in addition to being assistant principal, curriculum coordinator, and classroom teacher in Georgetown Public School. So a lot of wonderful different experiences in pre-K through 12.
Great. Now, you have quite a background. You're a published author. Received a number of awards. You do speaking engagements, and you're working on a book on school leadership?
Yes. Currently under contract, we're hoping the book will come out in the fall, writing a book about a leadership for people that are exploring universal design for learning. And universal design for learning was a project that is under the spearhead of the CAST, which originated, I believe, in Harvard University, and really is about providing mechanisms for all learners and representing things in ways they can understand them, presenting information in an engaging manner, allowing them to demonstrate their understanding and learning and active in differing ways. It's a brain-based research approach. And so the book is really about how we as leaders can model this approach in our leadership and also support the implementation of universal design for learning in our schools.
Wow, that sounds impressive. Now, you've also written a book about guiding principals.
So yes, as part of my dissertation, I published a book about the need to mentor principals. In particular, it was focused on elementary principals. We often in our elementary schools do not have assistant principals to support that work, so it's a lonely position, and there's a great need. There's a lot of research at the time when I wrote this that was supporting the need for teacher mentoring, and wasn't a lot of research about the need for administrators to be mentored, and so that's why I had focused my research on that.
Well, it certainly is an important topic, and I've actually spent some time in it as well. A friend and colleague of mine have been working for a number of years on trying to develop a serious game that would be a guide, if you will, for the next generation of educational leaders. So we will have to talk off the show about that sometime.
Absolutely, sounds exciting.
Tell me what it is. What was your role? You were an assistant principal at Fuller. What do you recall about that? And have you heard that that school's up for sale now? And
Yes, it was a number of years ago, and just starting my path to being in building level administrator. It was a wonderful experience when I was there, and I was there for 2 years, and I was the primary level, so the lower level up through grade two, assistant principal. And even at the time, there was some uncertainty about whether we were going to keep that school open or it would be readjusted and shifted. And actually, was one of the reasons that contributed to me looking to other opportunities, because there was some uncertainty back then. There was a financial concerns, and so I have known that there's been different iterations with the building since the time that I left. But very warm memories, wonderful staff, great community. I miss it very much.
Oh, great! Tell us about some more about the work you do as superintendent. I know you're also an educational consultant. What do you do as a consultant?
So since I started the superintendency, that train slowed a little bit because of the demands of the new position, but have been working supporting school districts through the implementation of educator evaluation. I have a background in supporting districts in data-based decision-making. What kinds of data do we have for our students, and how does that inform our work and our practice? And and then the last area that I tend to focus on is just general leadership support of our leaders in the district, and how we can work with them to hone their skills.
Great. Tell us about some of the data work that you do, and what are some of the data abstracts that you find are significant?
So one of the things that I have realized, and we're really pushing a model for this in my current district as well, is the use of academic and non-academic data. So not just looking and relying on specific assessment scores. We include those, we review those, we analyze those, but not having a full reliance on that. Really changing the way we engage in the use of data, so it's not just at the end of the year when we get test results, or the beginning of the year for last year, where we really can't use them at that point. So it's setting up a system where we have opportunities for staff to meet with one another. We have protocols for them to use so that the data can be used to inform their practice, and that we meet regularly to determine progress monitoring and growth of our students, that we have data measurements that look at that. But in addition to those pieces, which are not as new, it's not as new a concept as it had been in the past, is what I see is in potentially an over-reliance of us as educators on best practice, in quotes I put that. That one of the things that we really need to do is go back and look at research, and really, do we have, as leaders in the district and as teachers in the district, do we have access to databases of research, and using that to inform our practice, as well, as opposed to what we heard might work in a neighboring district only. So looking at our own data, trying to find ways to track it, trying to look at data in regards to what we spend our money on, what we as a district value, looking at data that is not just academic but in social-emotional realm, and then looking at what the research tells us our effective practices, and taking all of that information and identifying what our strengths as a district are and what our needs are.
Well, back in Gloucester, before you came on board, I was the school business administrator, and I worked for several superintendents, one of which was Dr. William Leary, who since retired, and he's down in Boca Raton enjoying his grandchildren. But he was interesting. He took and read every personnel folder of all of the staff all of the administrators, and then he cross-referenced it with 5 or 10 years of test scores in order to determine what the skill sets were going to be needed for succession planning of administrators to beef up areas that he found were deficient based on the test scores. Mm-hmm. And it struck me because there was, you know, we never heard anything like that before. You know, no one had ever taken the time to look at it. It just was more about, you know, preparing the packet for the school committee and passing the budget and no one looking at really sifting that fine into detail. So I guess the question that I'd ask you is, what do you see, you know, in addition to all the responsibilities you have as day-to-day running a school system and keeping school boards happy and all of that, what kinds of data do you see as part of your job, and what do you go digging for, if anything?
Well, just this past month, or November, I believe it was, we published a year-and-a-half-long study and a review of data for our district in regards to our needs assessment. And there were various pieces of data. Some of it's attitudinal, and that's also very important, too. What is the culture? What are the expectations? What are people's feelings? What are their prouds? What are their sorries? What are they invested in? What are they concerned about? And so there's a whole series of data points that we included in our needs assessment. The new educator evaluation framework actually does assess educators based on student performance. It's a new inclusion to the new model, whereas in the past it hadn't always. Mm. So we really do, when we create our goals, we call them SMART goals. And they're specific, they're measurable, they're attainable, they're realistic and time-bound. That's what the acronym stands for, and timely and rigorous. So when we create those SMART goals, we really are looking at student assessment information and looking at more growth measures, not just those achievement measures, looking at things not just in terms of proficiency, but in terms of growth, because there are a number of students that may or may not make the mark for proficiency, but their growth has been profound, and those educators need to be recognized for those talents that they have as well to move the student forward. So that's been a really great addition to the educator evaluation framework, is that we are looking at that information. The other change is when we do observational data and we observe staff and give them feedback, we do those as more often as unannounced observations. And one of the ways that we here are structuring that is through what we call CEI, which is claim, evidence, and interpretation. And it's based on the RBT, Research for Better Teaching model, which is much more comprehensive than I'm scaling it back to be. But ultimately, when we have a claim, there's a rubric for how we assess teachers. And so the claim should be aligned to the rubric. The evidence is what we saw. Did we script some specific things or observe specific things? And then the interpretation component is the impact on students. What is the impact of that instruction on our children? And that's really kind of what you're getting at when you talked about, you know, not just looking at what educators do, but what kind of impact they have on our kiddos, and really changing the framework for how we provide feedback to include that.
Great. Well, that's certainly sounds great and very progressive. I have to share a war story. I know a gentleman who's since retired, but he was a history teacher at our high school years ago, and he filed a grievance when he got his performance review, and he said, not you, not the principal before you, and not the idiot before him ever stepped foot in my classroom in 16 years. How can you tell me I'm doing a great job?
And I think that really was a distinction in previous models to what we had. Massachusetts Department of Elementary and Secondary Education actually created a framework that now all districts have that we have to employ. It has to be like or similar in nature. And so that model framework came out a few years ago, and that is now a statewide expectation, not from district to district, because as you remember, it was different in every district how we kind of employed our ed eval model, and now there's a lot more consistency, a lot more resources that are available to our districts, to our evaluators, and to our staff and teachers.
Well, the other side of that, too, I mean, you're talking about the evaluation, but the problem we faced at the district level, at the district office, was, you know, in the old days, you know, go back, set the clock back 10, 20, 25 years, the people who wrote the textbooks for graduate administration programs. The people who defined the classes at state colleges and universities for that would allow a person pursuing an administrative career to get the credits and have and address the certification requirements, and the people who set those standards at the various departments of education for different states, there were three separate silos, and they never talked to each other. They never had anything to do with each other. So you could have somebody come out of a state college or university with a master's or advanced certificate or even a doctorate in educational administration, and they don't have a clue how to handle a grievance hearing, how to address, you know, a civil service matter, or, you know, progressive discipline, or develop a budget, or any of that. That was all on the responsibility of each individual district to then teach them after they showed up. So it's nice to know that, and refreshing, really, that there's some consistency across the state and from district, and it's not the vacuum that existed for so many years.
Right, and the way we're evaluated is it's the same rubric across the way. And the other piece is I'm not sure that we've quite tackled that hurdle in terms of having our preparation programs really be fully authentic to the real work, and I think that's the benefit of the mentoring program.
Yes.
Currently, right now, most new superintendents are part of what the state calls a new superintendent induction program. It's a collaboration between the Mass Association of School Superintendents, Mass Association of School Committees, and the Department of Ed. And we are all, as members of if we participate in this program, we are provided with a coach, a comprehensive coaching model for the first 3 years of our work at the district level. And I think, again, that speaks to the need for, you know, not only kind of talking about what are the broad aspects of, and things about developing strategy and our entry plan, but having that individual coaching for the reality of the position, which is very unique and very distinct. And unless you're in it, you really can't prepare for it.
Sure. You're right. You're absolutely right. Well, thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. We certainly wish you the very best of success with your upcoming book and your continued work in school administration.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right. Next week is what?
Next week is the second week. We have the 11th. We'll have a show, and then we were off. I didn't plan for the school vacation week. And
good, because I'll probably be swimming at Good Harbor. I had planned on going skiing, but
yeah,
doesn't look like that's going to happen.
Well, I heard something about a storm on Tuesday that we actually.
Well, we'll have a storm, but I mean it'll rain and be in the 50s and 60s afterwards.
Yeah. Well, hey, you know it's the rodent did not see its shadow. So if you hold to that theory, and I'm told by. The person who knows all is all knowing on that stuff.
That would be a Republican, I gather.
It is. It's Barry Pett, who's the assistant and aide to Senator Tarr, and he said that the rodent is only accurate 44% of the time.
Oh no, that sounds.
But we
okay.
can we can hold out a certain amount of hope that we only have a couple more weeks of winter left.
No, you would hope that. All right. That's Josh Arnold. This is Trending Now. I'm Rick Moore.
Well, they can have it up north where you ski. But
well, they can't. They have the same weather up there that we do now, yeah. That we have here. It used to be a big difference in temperature, but not anymore. Anyway, that's the story for another day.
Global warming.
Well, whatever. I'll be back. Josh will be back. And don't forget, we've got high school basketball coming up tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. Bill Newell will bring you Wakefield hosting Melrose in boys high school basketball. Have a great day.
This is MSO Radio at msonewsports.com.